Well, good Monday afternoon, and welcome to The Scramble. We're beginning on a strange note because you're used to hearing Kyone Wolf in this spot, but she's got a terrible, terrible cold today. And whenever Kyone Wolf is out, I always sort of feel bad and sad that she's out, but it's also sort of a writing vacation for me. I don't have to write the opener. I dealt with an email this weekend. I get these occasionally, about once every 2 or 3 weeks, an email from a woman who wanted to salute me on my incredible intellect and the way that I had elevated a discourse here on WNPR, and then complain about the way Kyone Wolf and the things that she talks about are just dragging the show down into the sewer or gutter, as the case may be. And I had to explain that I write all of that material. So really, the person dragging the show down into the sewer and or gutter is me. But anyway, we're not down there today. We will wind up there at the end of the show because the last thing we're going to talk about today, you know, there's an old saw, an old political saying attributed to many Southern politicians that, you know, the only way you could get me out of office if I got caught with a live boy or a dead girl. And they never mentioned dead pig. But in fact, if you're following what's going on in Britain right now, Prime Minister David Cameron has been accused. Well, we'll get to it. Why jump in the gutter or the toilet any sooner than we have to, right? It's going to happen, but why not forestall it as long as possible? Make that woman happy. We're also a little bit later in the show, Alexandra Petri, one of my favorite, maybe my favorite young humor writer in America, and I are going to break down last night's Emmy Awards, and then she will assist me with the discussion of Piggate, and we'll talk about the dropping of the new Hamilton cast album, which is, it's rare for a Broadway cast album to be an event, but I think this is an event today because you can't go see Hamilton, so you can go get the CD anyway, or however you consume music these days. We are going to begin with the visit of Pope Francis to America, and very specifically our go-to guy on matters Catholic. That's Michael Sean Winters, a journalist who writes for the National Catholic Reporter, and I hear him rustling in the background there. Michael Sean Winters, are you there?
I'm here. Good to be with you, Colin.
So I think we share, I know that we share a sense based on what I've read in your column today about sort of the way, I mean, we sort of knew that this would be a somewhat political thing, that the politics and the slant that Pope Francis brings to economic issues and to climate issues, we're going to get the hairs up on the back of the neck, the necks of certain people. But I think you and I are both surprised at the tone that's been taken. I was reading George Will's column today, and I just, it's amazing to think of somebody like George Will writing so contemptuously and dismissively and toxically about the Supreme Pontiff. I mean, it's kind of like he's writing about just some random person he doesn't like very much.
Or Obama.
Right. Or,
you know, they tried this and it worked, which is, you know, 43% of the Republican Party now thinks that Obama's a Muslim. And that was 7 years ago, a very fringe belief. And as I wrote this morning in my column, you know, when the fringe becomes a base, you have a problem. And but I've been surprised at the venom. You know, they didn't. Obviously, there are political consequences to what the Pope says, but he's so obviously not a politician. And you tease out those consequences later. But this effort to preempt him is really a first, and I think it will backfire very badly. I think this is a time when the world, for a variety of reasons, international reasons as well as, you know, income inequality, people feel everything is out of kilter, and here's this man who is so completely centered, so completely human, and so completely not concerned with kind of petty political talking points. I think it will backfire on the right. I think this is very foolish.
I mean, in Cuba over the weekend, I'm sure he's not necessarily aware of things that are being said in the press in the U.S. just yet. But in Cuba over the weekend, he rather pointedly said, service is never ideological, for we do not serve ideas, we serve people. So that's to your point, that he's not really a political guy. He has beliefs that may play out in the political sphere, right?
Well, if it, you know, the church is concerned with the human person, and the human person is a political animal, so there's always going to be overlap or consequences. But I think, you know, that ideological point obviously cut one way in Cuba, and it will cut the other way in the United States, where, you know, where the Democrats don't have much in the way of an ideology these days, but Republicans do. And this is, you know, I think the concern is that, you have now, not just well-organized groups on the right who have bought into this kind of libertarian free market ideology, but that they're really well-financed. I mean, you know, the four pieces I called attention to all have some relationship to the Koch brothers. And I think that's something that really bears looking into by the leaders of the Catholic Church. They've got a fight on their hands, and I think it's going to make their fights with the Obama administration look like, you know, a day at the beach.
Well, I mean, and this sort of exists on two or possibly three fronts, this the way that the sort of frontiers on which the battle takes place. One of them is about climate change. I mean, he really wants that taken seriously in a way that a lot of groups, many of them, as you say, financed by the Koch brothers, do not want it looked at or taken seriously or acted upon. Another is in this area of accumulation of wealth. He gave this amazing 25-minute off-the-cuff speech in Cuba where he's talking about his vision for the global Catholic community, and he begged the religious. He said, love poverty like you love your mother. Wealth impoverishes, he said. It takes away the best that we have. It makes us poor. It places our faith in something else. So a guy saying that and then coming into, as you say, this free market libertarian environment here where the accumulation of wealth is rarely questioned in this society. If you can get it, you get it. He is going to seem, I think, like a bearer of a pretty radical message, don't you think?
Well, yeah. I mean, ours is a culture that produced, remember that TV show, Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous?
Yes, I do.
This is a man who spent all of his life with the poor and the forgotten. And so he's coming at it from a very different perspective. Part of this is you know, he's from the global south. So he has seen, you know, the consequences. They had that sovereign debt crisis in 2001 in Argentina, which is very similar to what in Puerto Rico. In fact, it's some of the same hedge funds who are you know, demanding these austerity measures that will harm the poor. So I don't think he has a dog in a fight about, you know, this economist versus that economist. His insistence is that we get past the ideas to, you know, what are the real world consequences of some of the decisions that we make. And I was at the Cato Institute last week debating this fellow, and you know, it's kind of pathetic. They walk out their talking points. Capitalism has lifted so many people out of poverty. Well, you know, I mean, the Pope is not in favor. He thinks it's a good thing that the Cultural Revolution and Maoism stopped, okay? But it's a little more complex. You know, it's not just that those are the only two options, is Maoism and spread eagle capitalism. There has to be something in between, or even better, something entirely new, a different way. I think, you know, the Pope gave a really interesting talk to a group of small cooperative banks and bankers, and he, you know, struck some of these themes about, you know, being embedded in your community, a much more local sense of the community, and I think the depersonalization that has happened in contemporary market economies is the worry that the human person gets written out. The administration is pushing again for this you know, Trans-Pacific, you know, trade pact. If that were to go through, one thing we know for sure is that jobs in Latin America will flee to Vietnam and Malaysia. I mean, these free trade treaties, they create this race to the bottom. That's wrong from the Pope's point of view.
The you know, in the church that I attend, we've been giving a close reading to the Book of Mark lately, and so this past Sunday we were talking about Mark 2. And in Mark 2, you know, you see over and over again in Mark, and maybe Mark in particular, but in the Gospels generally, this notion that Jesus has that you have to do the hard thing, not the easy thing. Whatever the thing that seems easy to you, forget about it. Somebody else can do that. You go do the hard thing. I'm going to go do the hard thing. I'm going to go eat with the tax collectors and the prostitutes and the people nobody likes because that's really who I need to be ministering to, not the people that are already popular. And also this kind of radical unsettling of the settled order, whoever it is, the Pharisees or whoever, he's going to say, well, no, there's something. I've got something bigger and better and more important to say than all of that, and you just have to get out of the way. And I really do. I mean, maybe we see Jesus where we want to see Jesus, but I really see him in Pope Francis. I mean, he's coming to America. He's going to visit prisoners. You know,
he is very fond of afflicting the comfortable and comforting the afflicted. And as you say, this, when these people start talking about, oh, well, you know, not all this stuff is infallible, or, you know, the poor benighted Argentine, he only understands understands crony capitalism in a kind of Peronist fashion and this stuff. You know, it's the gospel is what he's preaching. You know, they don't have a problem with Francis. They got a problem with Jesus. And he had a beautiful line in an interview with, I think it was a Portuguese radio station, where they said, you know, asked him about his own popularity. And he just responded, well, you know, Jesus was popular for a time. How did that work out? I mean, he's just, you know, he's not up for re-election. He doesn't have to raise money for a campaign. He is just channeling the gospel as best he can, and in a way that is so captivating. And a word that we've not mentioned yet is it's joy-filled. You know, very little. If you watched that Republican debate last week, and, you know, the same could be said really of a Democratic debate, there's no joy. And this man just radiates joy. It's not just the camera looking at him when he's with poor people. It's looking at their faces. And I just think that's contagious. And I think it will really, hopefully, have a very profound effect on our culture.
Obviously, he's speaking to a lot of different audiences at once, you know, just sort of a diverse audience of anybody who's around to consume his message, also to Catholic believers in this country, and also, I would assume, to the hierarchy of the church. I mean, the thing I read before about how you should love poverty and wealth impoverishes, he's talking to the religious at that point, and I'm wondering how that critique is going to land here. I mean, the way that he lives is kind of different from the way a typical American cardinal or archbishop lives.
Well, I mean, you know, we have, you know, it's hard to categorize all the American bishops as of one of one piece. You know, Cardinal O'Malley, when he arrived in Boston back in 2003, you know, chose to sell the mansion and move into the rectory. Archbishop Supich, who went to Chicago last year, same thing, chose not to live in the mansion. They're not selling it. They're going to repurpose it. And he's living in a room in the rectory. So a lot of these guys lead very, you know, simple lives, some less so. I think the bigger thing is there's been this narrative among the American bishops, or some of them, that we're at war with the culture, and you need to draw very clear boundaries between the church and the ambient culture. Mm-hmm. And he's not interested in building walls. He's interested in building bridges. The themes in his talks in Cuba, it's all about the culture of encounter, the culture of dialogue. And in a way, that may be the most distinctive thing to come to a highly polarized Washington and to challenge them to work together for the common good. This is pretty countercultural. You know? Yeah. So I think he but it does it. There are some bishops who are not happy. I mean, I don't want to minimize that. There are clearly some bishops who do not like this Pope and his style. But, you know, there's no end game if you're a Catholic and you're in opposition to the Pope.
We're talking to Michael Sean Winters right now from National Catholic Reporter. I want to go back to what you said at the beginning, because I think it's kind of important, too. So in July, Rush Limbaugh referred to Pope Francis as a clown. Fox News has aggressively attacked him for aligning himself with, quote, extremists who favor widespread population control and wealth redistribution. And then this George Will column that ran today, you know, Pope Francis embodies sanctity but comes trailing clouds of sanctimony. With a convert's indiscriminate zeal, he embraces ideas impeccably fashionable, demonstrably false, and deeply reactionary, and so on. And the column kind of goes on and on in this tone. And so what you're saying, and it's a really interesting point, is that one thing that's proven successful in some ways anyway in terms of not having the kind of dialogue the Pope might be advocating for here in the U.S. is to attack the person who holds the office right away in a way that kind of ignores whatever just default level subliminal respect that the office usually gets just for being in the office, right? It's like, you think we can't talk about the president that way? You think we can't call him a Marxist and a Muslim and a Kenyan? We're going to do that. We're going to say all that stuff. We're going to say it all the time. And so, I mean, once again, for somebody with Rush Limbaugh's forum, with his audience, his size, to call the Pope a clown, you know, but you're sort of saying the strategy is if you land that first blow, then you don't have to keep respecting the audience, the office.
I think, you know, it might work with a less gifted Pope, but I just think he is so authentically free and so obviously a good person trying to live out the gospel. I suspect some of Rush Limbaugh's listeners and George Will's readers see that, and even conservatives get turned off by it. I mean, I was talking to a priest this morning here in Washington. It was a pretty conservative, pretty well-heeled parish, and he said yesterday they were all, you know, very, very distressed by George Will's column. I think this they're playing with fire, and I will contrast that with, you know, the things I've been hearing from the Democrats has been not just more respectful, but much more of a willingness to acknowledge this Pope is challenging everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a much better way to embrace this, is just to say he's challenging everybody and to really listen to what he has to say. It's not going to be done overnight on something like climate change. Again, when you've got the extraction industries pumping tons of money into disinformation. But I think people, certainly Catholics, will listen to him, and most especially Latinos. I think this has been undervalued, is the degree to which this visit is going to have an impact on the Latino community. You know, Trump has been beating the hell out of them for 2 months, and no one has come to their aid. Why didn't Hillary Clinton get herself to a detention center? At least there she wouldn't be asked about her emails. But no one has really stood up for the Latinos. And here comes this Pope who's going to be speaking in Spanish.
Yeah.
And you can bet he's going to be defending, you know, immigrants. It's the only issue that all three cities have an immigration focused event.
You know, you sort of alluded to this in your piece, but it is sort of surprising, given the tenor of some of this discourse, that the sort of, I don't know, the Marco Rubios and the John Kasiches, people like that who might have an opportunity to say, hey, wait a second, this is the Pope. We're not going to talk about the Pope that way. We're, you know, I mean, that within the Republican Party, within the conservative movement, the moderates really haven't done much to defend him from these kinds of withering attacks.
No, including certain bishops who have, you know, street cred with the arch-conservatives. It's very strange, and I could imagine Kasich standing up and saying something. Boehner has continued to be very positive. Obviously, he issued the invitation to come and address Congress. I just, you know, we're in a really strange moment in American political life, and nominating contests bring out the worst in both parties. But here's a chance for them to take a break from all of that, or even better, to recalibrate and say, you know, we can't be talking about other human beings this way. And it's not realistic to deport 11 million people. And we'll see who rises to that. I was very disappointed to see that Marco Rubio, you know, opposed any intervention to help Puerto Rico. This is a man from Florida. He knows somewhere in his head you don't win the state of Florida unless you win that I-4 corridor, which has a lot of Puerto Rican votes along it in Florida. So it's even dumb politics.
Mm-hmm.
But they can't seem to break out of the cycle.
Well, meanwhile, in the rest of the world, it's like the Beatles. I mean, the other thing that, I mean, I'm sure I'm shocked at the venomous quality of some of that discourse. But I'm also, I wasn't quite prepared for the flip side of this. That, I mean, this is the Pope who's the Beatles. I mean, the way it's being talked about, the swag that people are trying to get, you know, it's kind of incredible. Did you see this coming?
Yeah, I think, you know, he's acutely aware that he doesn't want to come here and polarize the country further, but he's also very aware that he has to give voice to the voiceless, and that he is coming to the center of American political and economic power, and he's got something to say. And I think it might not have worked at a time if America was just, you know, going along fine.
Mm-hmm.
But we're aware that corporations are making these huge profits, and none of it has trickled down. And so I think he's going to strike a chord. I think it's really going to be fascinating. But again, so different from – there's no sense of grievance.
Mm-hmm.
There's no sense of anger. It is a stern call to justice, and it's deeply biblical. And I don't know how the right, which is, you know, fashions itself pro-family, but then is perfectly willing to deport, you know, support a deportation policy that separates husbands from wives and parents from children. This is nuts.
Michael Sean Winters, it's been great to talk to you. All the rest of you, if you want to enjoy another week of soulless materialism, you can do that. But after that, it's over. We're going to change here in this country. Thanks for joining us.
To God's ears.
That's right. All right. Michael Sean Winters from National Catholic Reporter. We will be back with a different kind of worship. worship of false idols, specifically the Emmys. So actually, just to wrap that up, on Sunday, Jim Chapdelaine went to church with me. And I never know which Jim Chapdelaine stories I can tell. I mean, the stories that he tells me, but I think I could tell this one. So the Pope, when he's in Madison Square Garden, is going to be using Billy Joel's sound system. Because like Billy Joel basically lives at Madison Square Garden anyway, so he's not going to take his sound system home. And so, but that means like everybody in the Billy Joel organization gets to meet the Pope. They're all like getting their backstage passes and their whatever security clearance they need and stuff. And I'm just thinking that whole thing about how Catholic girls all start so young or whatever. Billy might want to sort of downplay that particular selection when he's hanging with Pope Francis. But it's insanity. None of it makes any sense, but it's great. All right, so Alexandra Petri is joining us right now. She is my favorite young humor writer in America right now. And she writes the Compost blog for the Washington Post. And I knew when we first started talking about the Emmys, I just sort of intuited that Alexandra would be watching the Emmys and probably live tweeting them and writing something about it. And I thought, who better indeed to dish with about the Emmys? So I guess I just made a little bad pun there, didn't I?
Yes.
I wasn't thinking in those terms. Alexandra, welcome back to our show.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with a semi-serious point that you made, which is kind of, you kind of said the Emmys are the new Oscars, right? That in some ways, you know, the Emmys used to be this kind of third-rate award show. Like, how can you even give awards to television? It's enough that we let television exist and invade our homes and stuff, but nobody really associates it with great quality. But it's sort of the opposite now, right?
Yeah, no, these days, television is where you want to spend your time, because I think we figured out, well, if you want to actually meet a character who isn't that one man who squints at his work, that he's building a big machine so he can win an Oscar, and his wife is standing there in a nice shirt saying, no, honey, don't do it. Other than that, all the good stories are being told on TV. And because you have so much more time to spend with these characters and get to know them as people, and just comedically or dramatically, as Orange is the New Black is straddling categories, you have such a range of things being done. And so I don't know why TV still seems to think it's like the redheaded or other color-haired stepchild of movies, when in fact I'd much rather watch TV than, I mean, This Means War, for instance, not to name the worst Reese Witherspoon movie of recent years, but...
And actually, you just made another interesting point, which is that red-haired stepchildren are no longer the red-haired stepchildren. I don't know who the new red-haired stepchildren
are. Who's the hair? Yeah. Who are we maligning here?
Because gingers are obviously much more happening now than they were whenever that trope was coined. So the show opened. First of all, we should also say you liked the job, the hosting job done by Andy Samberg. Now say what you liked about it.
Well, I really liked the fact that he sort of got out of the way of the show. It ended right on time at 11, so I could go home and think about the Pope really hard, which is something I'm looking forward to doing all week. But he also didn't do any of those sort of self-indulgent long monologues where it's all about the host and how exciting he is. And he really just allowed people to shine. And he didn't punch down. There were like a couple of jokes that were duds, but he made jokes about Javert and Dagwood Bumpstead. And, you know, anytime anyone's making a joke about the print newspaper comics, you're in for a delightful evening, according to maybe six other people who agree with me.
Right. I mean, some of those references may be lost on people, but the references that are lost on people are good references, not bad references.
Oh, exactly.
They include those of us who actually get them. I thought the same thing. And obviously, you know, we can all think of the more horrifying reverse examples of this. But, I mean, I think you did hit on the most horrifying of them all. That would be Seth MacFarlane at the Oscars, right? You're still having PTSD?
Oh, my gosh. I'm still recovering from that. And the worst thing was I was in a room with people who were laughing at all the jokes with him and thinking that this was an enjoyable evening. And I had to keep looking at Twitter and saying, I'm not going insane, am I? This is awful, right? And fortunately, Twitter's there to confirm whatever you already believe. So it confirmed that.
So did you have favorite moments or favorite things that happened last night? We could swap a few if you want.
Yeah, well, I really enjoyed the speech by Viola Davis. Obviously,
yes.
That was a big moment. And I thought also because they didn't do any weird bits that we had to complain about the next day, it was able to get the credit that it deserved. It's just being – I thought what was really striking about it was that it was a speech – not like just like a political speech, but a speech about sort of the politics of art and how like this is the result of people working really hard to make opportunities for people to show what they can do. And instead of sort of stepping away and saying like, here's another cause, it's saying this is the cause. This is really important. This needs to keep happening. And so I thought it was a perfect moment and a really well done speech.
By the way, if you're listening here in the afternoon, we're live on the air. You can call 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You may tweet us at WNPR Colin. We're talking to Alexandra Petri from the Washington Post. Yeah, I mean, when she did that, I mean, first of all, she begins with this amazing quote that I wasn't really familiar with from Harriet Tubman, and soon to be on the $10 bill, probably.
Or the 20. There's still a chance to put her on the 20.
That's right, to do the right thing, yeah. Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know you feel like Ted Cruz is the only person who got that right in the last debate. So she begins with this kind of amazing quote about this line, and across the line there are these green fields with white women extending their arms towards her. And I was she didn't identify it as a quote from Harriet Tubman. So initially I thought, wow, this acceptance speech is going in a weird direction.
Oh. Please attribute these words.
Right. So, but then when it was clear what she was doing, the thing I'm always struck by is, you know, you really do have a pretty big audience if you're speaking at the Oscars or the Emmys or even the Tonys or the Grammys. You know, when almost everybody sort of puts on their bad glasses and takes this crappy little post-it out and starts, you know, and this year there was some kind of weird trope that you put your Emmy on the floor. I hadn't really seen that before.
Yeah, I was confused by that. It was like, give them a place to, like a stand maybe, or have a person there. Like, just have John Hamm stand there and hold everyone's Emmys so that he can touch as many Emmys as he deserves to touch.
Yeah, so, but you know, instead of actually saying something, I mean, you really have an opportunity to really say something. And she was pretty much the only person who fully exploited that opportunity. Everybody else had to thank, you know, some makeup artist they've been working with for 20 years.
Yeah, I wish there was some way where you could feed in a quick credits reel sort of to the teleprompter, and it would spin all the names of everyone you need to thank, and then you could just say your piece and not have to go, and Dave, who's always loved my son so much, even though he's my manager, and like all this stuff that is of limited interest to people watching at home.
Yeah, actually, that's a great idea. Maybe it could be preloaded. Everybody could preload all their little thank yous into, I don't know, some Instagram or Pinterest account or something, you know, and that'll just flash up on the screen, like, go look at that for all the people that this person wants to thank, and now they have an opportunity to talk. Although not everybody has something to say.
That's true. And people who don't have things to say often feel the need to say things, though. Right. So
one of the things that's always interesting to watch is that the people who either have been hosts before or might be hosts in the future or are just basically funny people who think in terms of shtick, they will inevitably experiment with something, see if they can do kind of a protracted riff on whatever presentation they're doing. So this time we saw Jimmy Kimmel come out and eat the part of the card that he was supposed to read that actually had the name of the winner on it, and kind of taunt all the nominees, saying that he's now in a position to make his own choice about
unlimited
it.
Power, yeah.
And Ricky Gervais came out and did this whole thing about how nobody really knows whether you won the Oscar or the Emmy later, so the important thing is to get a picture of yourself holding one as if you did. He kind of arranged that. And so what was your sense? I mean, how did those things go as far as you were concerned?
Well, to me, I didn't hate them because I knew that they were of limited duration, and you can endure anything for 3 minutes, I would say. And the fact that they were able to come in and do those bits for their 3 minutes and then leave the stage was what made them so great for me. I also, like, it was like seeing the ghosts of past bad hosts, or not bad hosts, not uniformly. I think Jimmy Kimmel did an endearing job, and my grandparents are big fans of him now that Jay Leno's off the air. They enjoy watching Kimmel, so I don't want to speak ill of him. But I just thought it was nice to see what we could have been experiencing. It was like a glimpse into a parallel universe of the alternate Emmys that didn't get to be.
Right. And, you know, speaking of alternate Emmys or Emmys that might be, I mean, I thought somebody else pointed this out today, that maybe unintentionally the person who kind of wound up auditioning to be an Emmy host is John Oliver. John Oliver did this fabulous riff, which people should just go and look up. We won't play it right now. This fabulous riff on why Jeopardy can never go off the air. It will never go off the air. And, you know, when the Earth is extinct, as he says, the last sound to come from the Earth will be Alex Trebek sighing one last time.
Gently admonishing a Canadian librarian.
Right. And so between that and the clip that they played of John Oliver talking to these Muppet-like puppets about mass incarceration. I mean, you realize that, you know, the Emmys do kind of celebrate the thing that was good a little while ago and sometimes miss the thing that's really good right now. So the Emmys were really awash in sentimentalism for The Daily Show and Jon Stewart, not unjustifiably. But, I mean, the Daily Show just racked up all kinds of awards. But really, when you think about it, Oliver's the guy who's kind of doing the interesting experimentation right now or trying some interesting stuff. And he really was good on stage right now on this particular broadcast. Can you see John Oliver in the future maybe doing this job?
Oh, I'd love to see them doing this job. I think he's doing a terrific thing with his show where he, and of course, like now we've gotten to the point where there's like a backlash to the overwhelming embrace of it, because every morning on Monday, without fail, you see all these pieces saying, watch John Oliver sock it to everything. But he really does sock it to everything. And I think he's a delightful and welcome presence. And his Jeopardy joke just served to confirm that. So I'd love to see him continue to host things or start to host things or whatever the appropriate verb is. I think he's doing great work. And also Jon Stewart's beard. We need to see more from that beard. That beard was doing yeoman work.
Well, it's been a lot of places. I mean, it's been in wrestling rings and on The Colbert Show and under an umpire's mask and all kinds of stuff. So, you know, I don't know. Did you watch Olive Kitteridge? Olive Kitteridge.
I didn't. Yeah. I heard it said it was like sad, melancholy people whose lives aren't going well. And I just thought, well, I'll just go to happy hour and hang out with my friends.
Yeah, I watched it. It's not, I couldn't believe the number of awards this thing. I mean, it was good. It wasn't terrible or anything like that, but it really was. I mean, it wasn't as good or as interesting as Wolf Hall or American Crime or The Honorable Woman. I clearly watched too much television there.
Yeah, I was about to say.
But
you and Andy Samberg both managed to get into your bunkers and tear through everything.
That's right. But yeah, I just was amazed at that. What did you, I loved that opening bit, that whole idea. He begins with this premise that there really is too much, the so-called peak TV premise, right? That there's almost too much good TV. You can't watch it all. So he goes into the bunker and watches all of it, apparently except for Castle, which he misses and has to go back in and get it. Although I did think, Alexander, that at a certain point they were really showing us some shows that he probably could have skipped in the bunker. Like,
don't need to watch every show with wives in the title, as he suggested he was doing.
Yeah, I personally think, not that I've actually seen this show, but I see so many clips of it every Emmys. He probably could have skipped that American Horror Story freak show thing, which I actually thought that was the name of the Republican presidential debates, but apparently there is there's a program called the American Horror Story Freak Show thing. But yeah, I actually did think that was a pretty funny premise. So anybody else who jumped out at you, either in terms of surprises or people who were unfairly denied Emmys?
Well, I don't know. I feel like having Key and Peele, sort of splitting them up. There should be like a category for a variety show that's distinct from like the fake news show category. Am I crazy? I feel like that way we could honor all the sketch shows and not have to divvy up our joy. But
well, there's a lot of that lumping in. I mean, I saw this with a sort of featured actor or whatever it's called, actress in a comedy show, and so there are all these people, you know, who are in sort of fictional roles on comedy shows, and then Kate McKinnon from Saturday Night Live. Well, I think Kate McKinnon walks on water. I think she's amazing, but she's doing...
Yeah, I worship the water she walks on.
Right. She's doing a really different job than the other four or five people in her category. I think that would be another one. It makes sense to put that someplace else.
Yeah, there should also be like a category for like elevates their material, no matter what material they're given.
Right.
So you could... Vanity and variety categories are always fun to come up with. But yeah, like somebody who's like been snubbed a lot, or like person who's great in a show that isn't that great, that's the category you could have. Or like person who's in a show that is so subtle that nobody notices how much acting everyone's doing, like Mad Men could just sweep that category. Or like show with boobs, like you could categorize everything.
You're getting back to Seth MacFarlane territory there. Be careful.
No, that was just Game of Thrones.
Oh, Game of Thrones, okay. So, speaking of Game of Thrones, I did think that Peter Dinklage did something that I always wish somebody would do, and it happens so rarely. So, you get nominated with a bunch of other nominees, you win the award, you go up on stage, and, you know, people are pretty good these days about saying, well, the other nominees are so great, you know. And so, sometimes if they're really careful, they'll rattle off the names, you know, of the other four nominees. So that's like the next level of virtuousness. But Peter Dinklage did something else. He basically said who he thought should win the award.
Yes. He said one name, and then he said, and the rest.
Right. I've never seen that happen before where he basically said Jonathan Banks, who's on Better Call Saul, and then he said, and the rest.
Yes.
It was like, well, what would you conclude about what was just said there if you were any of the other nominees, basically that he's got his own pick?
Oh, yeah, or I could conclude that he loved all of us, but he just didn't feel that he had enough time, and he was going alphabetically, and I'm sure I would whisper that to my mirror in the morning, sadly, as I tried to reassure myself that Peter Dinklage loved me, too, because, as you said, the evidence is overwhelmingly in the other direction.
Well, I mean, Peter Dinklage, you know, they cut to him when they said his name, and he was kind of shaking his head, like, you know, are you crazy? I've already got one of these.
This is very kind of you, but... Right. I will pass.
It may have just been he didn't really feel like walking all the way back up there, you know?
Also, he had that bun, and he didn't want people to have to stare at his man bun any longer than necessary.
Yeah, I know you
Unless you were pro the man bun. I don't know. The internet seemed divided.
Right. I know you were anti-man bun. One person that I really like a lot, and I've enjoyed her in other series, particularly Southland, and I was a big fan of American Crime. I was happy to see Regina King win. I think there's somebody people don't even probably know very well, haven't seen her in very much. But
she's been secretly ubiquitous for years. Like The Boondocks, she did the voices for The Boondocks.
I didn't know that.
And yeah.
So
look
that,
it up.
That could be another Alexandra Petri category. Secretly ubiquitous for years.
Yes, secretly ubiquitous for years.
You have four or five nominees there, and you pick one. The one person who...
Sufi.
I like that. One person who won me over. I'm talking way too much, but I want to hear your favorite. So one person who made me happy last night is Adrian Brody. And I'm almost nervous with Adrian Brody because of what he did with Halle Berry.
It's like, you never know what's going to happen when he gets onto that stage.
Right. You can't really give him an award with a female presenter. You're just asking for trouble at this point. It's like having Anthony Weiner come out there. I mean, you're just like, you know, you're just begging for something bad to happen. But he was introduced as a presenter, and Andy Samberg said, you know, I like standing next to him because then I have kind of a cute button-down nose or something like that. And Brody came out, and he tried to talk, and he kind of broke a little bit, and he started laughing. And I thought, a guy who can laugh about a joke about his nose, you know, in front of an international audience.
Yeah, that's like Cyrano de Bergerac-level panache.
Right. You got to like that guy. Yeah, you got to. I mean, there's a lot of people in that audience who probably couldn't laugh about their own noses. Any other big takeaways from last night for you?
Well, I've come up with another category, which is we should have an Amy's, just give awards to all the great Amy's on television, because Amy Schumer, Amy Poehler, and I'm sure more Amy's would emerge from the wings if we created an award show exclusively for Amy's, and I'd be happy to watch them receive things. I actually wish Amy Schumer had, like, had a more of a prepared speech, because she had a very charming speech, but everyone sort of knew / hoped that she was going to prevail after her big 2015, and it would have been cool to hear some of that trademark Schumer humor, a phrase that should never be heard again because it's terrible. But
I mean, you kind of want to see her push the envelope a little bit. I mean, that's kind of one of the things that she does pretty well.
Yeah, and you give her an envelope. Usually she, like, shoves it across the table. And instead, this time she was just charming and there and timed perfectly for when she said 10 o'clock she was going to have a blackout, and then she won her award at like 9:57 and dashed off. So
I'll tell you one of my favorite moments, just because it sort of illustrates something that never changes. So Samberg and I'm blocking his name right now, but the guy was Seth Meyers.
Seth Meyers.
Seth Meyers.
So
they,
like,
did, they did this kind of funny thing about about Lorne Michaels, and they had this mug. This is best boss ever. They're going to give it to him. Then they open up the envelope, and it's not him. It's Shonda Rhimes, and he's not even in second place. It's Lee Daniels. And they did a really good job with it, and their timing was really good. You can tell they worked very well together. But you know what? When they cut back and forth to Lorne Michaels, they weren't really ever getting a laugh out of him. And I was thinking, boy, some things probably never change. Here are these guys who've gone on to other things. They've got their own shows, their own series, their own success. They're both hosted award shows. They're still like fawning coach dogs trying to get the approval of Lorne Michaels. I mean, they'll be doing that for their whole lives.
He's the elusive father of comedy. I'm sure like there's some sort of like Freudian interpretation where you could say if Lorne Michaels had ever cracked a smile, then people would have, they'd all stop working and they'd sit down and they'd say, we've accomplished what we set out to accomplish. And then you'd have to get, you know, a whole new crop of people hosting late night shows.
Yeah, there are all these broken little boy comedians going, if you'd ever just taken the afternoon off and thrown the football around with me or something, but no, he was always
Why don't you love me, Lorne?
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We have two other things we do want to talk to Alexandra Petri about. They are not the Emmys. They are other things. One of them involves a pig. That's all I'm going to say.
Baby and me, we switched round and round till half past dawn. There was 57 channels and nothing on. 57 channels and nothing on. 57 channels and nothing on.
All right. We're with Alexandra Petri here on the Scramble. I do have to thank people because Kyan Wolfia usually does that. Thanks for Betsy Kaplan. She's on the board today. Helped out with a whole bunch of other stuff. Tucker Ives produced the show. Amanda Gallagher's handling phones and other stuff for us. And I'm sure there's lots of other people who should be thanked. My agent, my... okay, I won't thank those people.
Lorne Michaels.
Lorne Michaels. Alexandra Petri is with us. She has many things that she has to get ready for this week, including the Pope, the incredible excitement that's building around the new Rob Lowe. Fred Savage show. Boy, that's going to be great, right? Rob Lowe and Fred Savage together. Why didn't somebody think of that so much sooner?
I don't know. I guess they weren't available. They were too busy working on like all the other many things that they've made us excited about.
Exactly. So, but there are other things to be excited about today, including, and I don't know the last time the dropping of a Broadway cast album was, you know, exciting enough to be kind of a very prevalent, trending hashtag. I think hashtag Oklahoma was very big in its day. But so the
hashtag 1776.
Yeah, there you go.
Hashtag the Music Man.
So those were big. Those were hashtags. Those were trending on Twitter in their day. But the dropping of the Hamilton soundtrack, we actually have a little tiny taste of it for you. NPR Music is streaming it today. But here we go.
If we win our independence, is that a guarantee of freedom for our descendants? Or will the blood we shed begin an endless cycle of vengeance and death with no defendants? I know the action in the street is exciting, but Jesus, between all the bleeding and fighting, I've been reading and writing. We need to handle our financial situation. Are we a nation of states? What's the state of our nation? I'm past patiently waiting. I'm passionately smashing every expectation. Every action's an act of creation. I'm laughing in the face of casualties of sorrow. For the first time, I'm thinking past tomorrow.
And I am not for the way my shot.
So, Alexandra, you know, there's FOMO, fear of missing out, and YOLO, you only live once. I suffer from LOU, which is left out of Hamilton.
I thought you were going to say FOMO, fear of missing out on Hamilton.
Well, I so far have, so I have LOU. I'm left out of Hamilton. Have you actually seen the show yet, or do you have LOU as well?
I managed to see it, actually, which, like, I got one of those, like, nosebleed seats where your view is obscured by a bunch of enthusiastic but confused middle-aged women, but I did get to see it.
Yeah, there are even worse seats where your view's obscured by somebody having a nosebleed.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you don't want those. That's like the worst possible seat that you can get. But this is, it kind of is, I think you called it Christmas, right? You know, I mean, this is music people really want to hear from the Broadway stage. Kind of unusual.
It's true. I think Hamilton, to me, what's so cool about it is that it doesn't waste any time trying to be a cool musical. It's so unabashedly dorky and exuberant about its material. Like, there's one point where during a song, Lin-Manuel Miranda, who's playing Hamilton, does an aside where he's like, this fact about a tomcat is true. And it's so exuberant. And I've been, like, trying to bootleg it off the internet for weeks, and I bought it on iTunes because the only thing you can find is the version of Lin-Manuel ran up performing the original opening rap number at the White House, being like, I'm working on a concept album about our founding father, and which does a better job. I've been reading the book. I'm so desperate to like get the lyrics into me, which is when you're reading a 728-page biography of a founder so that you can get access to a musical, you know that something's going to awry with your life. But
well, it is. I mean, as a premise, it is. It's borderline, you know, Saturday Night Live sketch, right? I'm writing a musical about Alexander Hamilton. I mean, it really sounds like a bad idea if you didn't already know it's, you know, the biggest hit since Book of Mormon.
No, but I think that's the genius of it, because there's no sort of like quotation marks around it. Because usually when you have a show, as you're saying, it sounds like a sketch. It sounds like a joke premise where it's like, oh, no, a musical about Alexander Hamilton, first secretary of the Treasury. Oh, boy, that's going to be bloody, bloody Andrew Jackson all over again. But instead, he's like, no. If you just look at the material, this is a guy who, on the strength of his writing, was able to catapult himself from, you know, being the illegitimate orphan son of a woman of loose repute and a Scotsman dropped in a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by providence and poverty and squalor, grew up to be a hero and a scholar. Can you tell I've been listening to this all morning?
Either that or you're just an amazing freestyler. I couldn't decide which it was.
But it's a really cool American story, and it's very of today, because the idea that you can get out of a really horrible situation by being intelligent and by being proactive and by going for it, you know, everyone can relate to that. That's the American dream.
Well, that's
he was the most hip-hop of the founders.
That's hashtag Hamiltons. I've deliberately left us about 3 minutes and only 3 minutes, thinking, like, how much trouble could we really get into, Alexandra, in 3 minutes of radio time? But the other hashtag of the day is Piggate, which is very heavily trending. This is involves a new book.
Oh.
A new book that's out. It's an unauthorized. As I said, not to quote myself on Twitter, which is horrible, but I said, you know, once you know that one of the big sentences, you know, he had engaged in sexual activity with a dead pig, you don't really have to point out that the biography is unauthorized at that point.
I mean,
that kind of goes without saying. But this is about the Prime Minister, David Cameron, and it is suggested that while joining some kind of Oxford club, this bad boy, rowdy, bad choices Oxford club. That's the name of the club. It's Bad Personal Choices.
Bad boy, rowdy, bad choices.
Yeah. Hugh Grant belonged
to the club. Pierce Gaveston was a poor personal choice for Edward II.
Yeah. So, So Pierce Gaveston is the name of the club that he inserted part of himself, we think, into the mouth, I think, of a dead pig. I don't know if there's anything that you can even say after I say that, but
yeah. Oink. No. I'm trying to I think every time I've been trying to write about this all day, and I'm trying to think, well, maybe if we try to defend him, and the second you try to defend him, you realize how completely crazy this premise is. You're like, well, who among us hasn't inserted? Nope. All among us. Everyone else among us has not inserted anything into a pig, let alone like a dead pig. I feel like we're letting the fact that this was a pig obscure the fact that it was a deceased pig, which shouldn't go unremarked on. I also just quoted my Twitter self there. As George Bernard Shaw says, I often quote myself. It adds spice to my conversation. So he's existing and
right.
Surviving.
If he and Oscar Wilde had Twitter, they would be just as bad as the rest of us.
They'd be worse.
But funnier also. So yeah, I think that's a brilliant idea, though. I think writing a spirited, you know, well-reasoned argument in favor of Cameron, you know, that really this is all about the freedom to make choices, to make personal choices, and that, you know, maybe he's opening up a whole frontier for people, you know, that something that people really didn't necessarily feel comfortable talking about.
This is the end of Animal Farm, if I'm remembering correctly. This is like where everything ultimately converges. It's two legs good, four legs better or something. Maybe that's the one pig joke that hasn't already been made on Twitter, because literally every possible pig joke has been made in the first like 30 seconds of this news coming out. Everyone took to their guns and just went for it.
Right. I tried to make a babe joke as quickly as possible, but I was just way behind everybody else. Yeah.
So yeah, somebody had a great joke. They should call this Bay of Pigs, which is funny if you see it spelled out because it's B-A-E. But okay,
all right.
Nothing funnier than explaining a joke.
Yeah, you know, when you have to spell it, it's going to slow you down a little bit. We are out of time. I'm sure the people who run this radio station are really happy to hear that we are out of time. We've been talking to Alison Petri. She's a Washington Post columnist. Thanks for joining us today. We will be back tomorrow with George Packer and his book, The Unwinding. I'm pretty sure there's nothing about pigs in it, but let's double check and make sure.
Tu cuerpo para alegría Macarena, que tu cuerpo te da la alegría, cosa buena. Dale tu cuerpo para alegría Macarena, Macarena.